You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. And joining me now, Doug Casey, international man. It is so good to have you back. We've had such positive feedback about last time we spoke. And there's a lot that's gone on in the last 6 months, Doug. And I just wanted to catch up with you and get your take on what's been going on. How are you? Good morning.
Well, I'm fine and dandy at the moment. And I'm speaking to you now from the shores of the Chesapeake Bay in Virginia. But I'll be returning to the Southern Hemisphere after a jaunt to the Orient. I'll be back there in November.
So, of course, you're based in Buenos Aires, and that's what we talked about last time a little bit. Just we'll get started. Javier, how's he getting on now that he's had his boots under the desk for about 8 or 9 months? Have the protests settled down and people got their heads around things?
Well, let me reemphasize that he was elected. Javier Milei in Argentina is actually unique in world history. He's the only person that's ever run for an election on a platform, an anarcho-capitalist platform. In other words, he overtly wants to get rid of the government in every way possible. Certainly get rid of it from any economic intervention or social intervention in people's lives. And Argentina has been run into the ground for so long that especially the youth in Argentina voted for him overwhelmingly. And now that he's been in office over 6 months, people still support him because they realize they're not, the average person is not an economist, but kind of realizes that all this dead weight in the government, government employees who are paid to make your life miserable and steal money from you in taxes and lower your standard of living with their regulations and everything, they're quite happy to see him firing tens of thousands of basically worthless hangers-on. So I'm optimistic about Argentina. And over the rest of his term, and I hope he's reelected, I suspect that Argentina is going to be one of the most prosperous and successful countries in the world.
So you think that that could be a template for many Western nations?
Well, I hope it's a template, but look at New Zealand. When I moved to New Zealand as a landed immigrant, when was that? Well, it was just after Roger Douglas, I guess, got involved in the economy. When I moved there, I came to New Zealand for the polo, believe it or not, because a lot of Kiwis don't even know that New Zealand has the highest per capita number of polo players of any country in the world. Well, it's a very athletic country, of course, so it kind of makes sense. But Roger Douglas's reforms transformed New Zealand. I mean, when I first got there, it impressed me as a backward little country caught in a time warp where any young person with anything on the ball and enough money to get on a plane to Sydney or London or Los Angeles did it. So you had a brain drain, you had a capital drain, country was going nowhere, and he reformed it. And things got so much better in New Zealand, as far as I'm concerned, or I think everybody was concerned. But then what happens? Things get good for long enough. And what do? They elect, who is that silly biddy that, Jacinda.
Jacinda.
Yeah. So it wasn't an ideological revolution in New Zealand. It was just a time for a change, practical. Let's do something practical. And then what do? They elect the worst possible person in the form of Jacinda. Now, who do you have now? I guess this guy currently is a big improvement. But what you need in New Zealand is an ideological revolution where the average Kiwi has to figure out, wait a minute, the state is a dead hand on society. The state is our enemy. Let's cut it back and not just trim the state around the edges, trim the government around the edges, pull it out by the roots. And then after you pull it out by the roots, so Agent Orange where it grew, so it can't grow back. And I'm not kidding. So that's what I hope Kiwis do. But will they do it? No, I don't think so. They elected Milei in Argentina because things had gotten so bad there, they felt there was no alternative other than to do something radical. But things have not gotten that bad yet in New Zealand. Things will have to get worse before they get better in New Zealand, is my thought.
Do you think that they actually might be coming to that conclusion in the United Kingdom right now?
No. No, I don't. The prognosis for the United Kingdom, the way I see it, is very bad. They've totally caved in to political correctness and wokeism. And the fact is that Englishmen have become an endangered species. I mean, everybody remembers a generation ago that when you went to England, there were a few Indians and Pakistanis. So you had some, you know, some nice exotic restaurants, but they were 3 or 4% of the population. Now they're closing in on, I mean, foreigners from alien cultures, let's put it that way, 20% of the population, and the trend is accelerating. And the average Brit is so weak-kneed and so accepting that the place could turn into a caliphate in another generation. So the prognosis is not good for what's left of England, I don't think.
No.
Let me go further. When we talk about England, since they elected this absolutely dangerous and horrible person, Keith Starmer, there have been, that I know of, just what I picked up here in the U.S., at least a dozen instances of people just posting something that's mild, an observation of reality, nothing, saying something unkind or semi-harsh about Islam or God knows what. They're putting them in jail for a year or 2 years. This is out of control. This is actually what's going on in England now is actually what happened in the movie V for Vendetta, which came out 20 years ago. We're seeing it in real life.
Yeah. Which then sort of brings me to sort of these clusters of crises that have been going on around the world. We had the pandemic, which was this global, so-called global event, which really was just a bad case of the sniffles. But it allowed governments to bring in exorbitant amounts of control over the population, where they can go, what they can do. And in order to keep them compliant, essentially bribe them in most Western nations. So they were paid to stay home, paid to be prisoners, paid to shut up and go, don't worry about it, we're doing this to keep you safe. We're now seeing the effects of that with rampant inflation. You know, I think I saw something the other day for the United States. They were talking about the inflationary number, if you actually measured it properly, was something in the vicinity of around 127%, as opposed to the number that Janet Yellen would like you to think it is. And people are seeing it. They're seeing it in the grocery store. They're seeing it every time they fill up their car. They're seeing it when they're trying to transact just every single day. Even if they have a limited amount of financial knowledge, everyday people are now aware something is very, very stinky in the state of Denmark, and they know that it's wrong. How do we then get things back to rights within this crisis situation? How do we circumvent what the governments would like us to do and create our own financial freedom, true financial freedom?
Well, I think we're in a lot of trouble. And the reason I say that is that ever since the founding of the Fabian socialist movement 100 years ago, the Fabian socialists have been operating on the premise that you start in the schools, grade schools, high schools, universities, graduate schools, and you indoctrinate people there. And these people get into the media, they get into business, they further indoctrinate the kids. You get into entertainment, where people that are thought leaders, well, thought leaders, that's probably not the right word, but influencers, come out with all these stupid, thoughtless ideas of collectivism, of something for nothing. So it's a question of the countries, New Zealand, but also the U.S. and most Western countries, have been psychologically and intellectually corrupted at this point. And it's going to take a long time to turn it around, I'm afraid. We have reality on our side, so I think it can be turned around more quickly than the corruption occurred. But we're in for a real rough patch over the next decade or more, I'm afraid. So I don't have a solution. My solution is only that people should try to study and understand these things as individuals. Well, most people aren't going to do that. That's hard work. And talk to their friends and neighbors as individuals using logic and critical thinking. I don't know, but I become quite pessimistic about the way this is all going to evolve, frankly. I don't have a magic solution.
No. So then a few weeks ago, the jobs number came out in the US, and it was a little bit worse than they were expecting. And there was this absolute, the markets went crazy. So was that sort of an indication, a canary in the coal mine of what could come? Or was it just a whole bunch of markets getting the yips over nothing at all? It was like a horse getting spooked, a bumblebee.
Well, in the first place, I wouldn't plan your life around the accuracy of numbers coming out of government agencies. I trust U.S. government numbers just marginally more than I trust Argentine government numbers, which have gotten better since Milei's in office. But governments have a natural tendency to make everything look better because they're in charge. So I think that what we're headed into is a gigantic depression throughout the Western world. Let me define the word depression. It's not necessarily like what happened from 1929 to 1946. Let's define the word properly. A depression is a period of time during which most people's standard of living falls significantly. So that's what we're looking for. And why do I say that? It's because since the state has taken over for many years now, generations, the monetary system, inflating the currency, discouraging people from saving. I mean, it used to be people understood, if I want to become solid or even wealthy, I have to produce more than I consume and save the difference. That's pretty simple. But when the currency is being inflated out from under you, you're a fool if you save the currency. So if you're going to get ahead, at best, you want to speculate. Or maybe, if you're more clever, borrow a lot of money and hope that your debts will be inflated out from under you. But the problem with debt is you're either borrowing things that people have produced and saved in the past and obligate you, or worse, mortgaging your future for consumption today. So I think that much of the economy is built on sand, unstable ground. And a lot of people are going to have to find new lines of work in the future. I'm very optimistic about the long-term economic future, incidentally. Why? Because despite all the terrible things that government does to the money, or in all the ways that it stops you from producing and steals what you do produce, still, the average person's wired like a squirrel, and we all try to put some nuts away for the future. So that's a positive for society. The other thing is that science and technology keep compounding upon themselves and increasing our standard of living with breakthroughs in science and technology and engineering. So for the long run, I think it'll work out fine. For the short run, I'm a little bit more worried. In fact, much more worried about the way it'll happen, the way it'll work out.
So one of the things we've talked about, of course, has been the inflation of the US dollar especially. And, of course, back in the bad old days, it used to be attached to gold in terms of its value, piggybacked on that, and then Nixon unhitched it. And then the Saudis sort of came into play in terms of the oil, I think, sort of hitched that pony there to an extent. Now, that's just quietly let lapse in recent months. What is the future for the US dollar? And is there, I mean, can it rehitch itself to gold? Can you re-monetize gold like it used to be in the bad old days?
Well, it's definitely going to happen, because none of the countries of the world want to base their currencies on the dollar anymore. That worked out for a while. First, Nixon defaulted on the pledge to redeem a fixed number of dollars for a fixed amount of gold. That was stable. And then, of course, it was currency for oil. Now, of course, the Saudis and other oil producers have no respect for either the U.S. or certainly for its dollar. In fact, what a lot of the countries of the world are doing now is purposefully getting out of the dollar. They realize that the U.S. dollar is a hot potato. They realize that for the last 40 years, the major export of the U.S. has not been Boeing's or soybeans or IBM's. It's none of that. Our major export has been dollars. And these nice foreigners take our dollars because they're fungible, they're liquid, they're tradable, and send us Mercedes and Sonys and cocaine and all kinds of other things that are imported from abroad. But now there are tens of trillions, nobody knows exactly how many, U.S. dollars that are in the hands of foreigners. Okay, the problem with that is that Americans, under legal tender laws, must use U.S. dollars as a currency within the U.S. or with each other. But foreigners don't have to do that. And it's foreigners accepting the paper currency, the fiat currency, paper of another country, it's all based on convenience and confidence. And confidence can blow away like a pile of feathers in a hurricane. And at some point, I don't know what the next catalyst will be, people will start dumping those dollars. But dumping them to who? If everybody wants to sell, who's going to buy them? Well, I'll tell you what's going to happen. They'll come home to the United States, where you can trade them for things in stores or share certificates or real estate or whatever. And at that point, sometime in the not too distant future, you're going to have trillions and trillions of dollars coming back to the U.S. buying stuff in America. This is one reason why the standard of living of Americans will collapse. They'll have lots of paper that they shipped out before, but now it's going to come back home, and they're going to have less real goods that other people around the world will own. And at that point, the U.S. government will put on foreign exchange controls to stop it from happening. And that's only going to exacerbate the problem, because then people will say, my God, I got to get around these foreign exchange controls somehow, and the market value of the dollar will fall further. And of course, in the meantime, even right now, the U.S. government is running a $3 trillion a year deficit. Where are they getting that money? The Chinese aren't lending money to the U.S. anymore. They're selling debt to the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve gives them Federal Reserve notes. They do this by printing up money. So inflation is baked into the cake in the U.S., regardless of what the figures say currently. So right now, we have a kind of a lull before the storm, and people should be taking advantage of this lull before the storm to kind of get ready for the storm.
Mm. Like here in New Zealand, our debt has blown out now to $215 billion. Squealer Robinson, as I like to call him, he threw money around, helicoptered money around during COVID, and it just absolutely snowballed here comparative to our size. One of the things I wonder, I mean, you mentioned the Fed before, but if it all goes pop, I mean, who does this, who called in the tickets? Who calls in the chits when they finally go, yeah, I'm calling that back in now? I mean, is it the Fed? Is it the Chinese? Is it who is it? Because that money must be owed to something or someone, or are they just printing it like tissue paper?
Yeah, most central banks, like the Reserve Bank in New Zealand, all over the world, their major asset is generally U.S. dollars. And it's becoming apparent to them that they've got the on-backed liability of a thoroughly bankrupt and irresponsible government. So, and they saw what happened to the Russians, where any dollar asset of a Russian or the Russian government just disappeared. Well, that can happen to anybody. This is why the Chinese government, which was the largest holder of dollars, has been unloading them wholesale, especially over the last 6 months. And you're going to find other banks, central banks, following the example of the Chinese. But they need some kind of an asset to hold, to replace those dollars. And the fact is that they're buying gold. This is why gold has been going up. It's not retail buying from the public. The public is oblivious to all of this stuff. But central banks realize, we have to hold something. Do we want to hold Russian rubles? No, that doesn't make sense. Want to hold Chinese yuan? No. You want to hold euros? God, no. The EU is going to break up and the euro is going to disappear. What do you hold? Well, you hold gold, which is the only financial asset that's not simultaneously somebody else's liability. That's also true of Bitcoin, but Bitcoin is a new asset, kind of a special situation. But basically, you buy gold. And that's what they're doing. That's what the Chinese are doing. That's what the Russians are doing. That's what everybody's doing, quite frankly, which is why it's at 2,500 US and I think going a lot higher in the next few years out of fear. Well, first out of prudence, then out of fear.
Hmm. So explain the difference to me between buying gold and buying gold stocks.
Oh, big difference.
Hmm.
Big difference. So, I've long been a fan of gold ever since. Look, I'm shocked to say that I've been buying gold for 50 years. I'm that old. And I've never sold a single ounce I bought, ever. So I started buying it at around $40 an ounce. And it's treated me very well. I treat it as an asset. It's money in its basic form. I buy gold stocks, or I should say speculate in gold stocks for a different reason, because they're a very leveraged way of playing gold. And gold mining itself is a terrible industry. It's a crappy 19th century choo-choo train industry. It's always been risky. I mean, back in the days of Deadwood, if you found a gold mine, it was wonderful. It was like finding a gold mine. I mean, you were in chips. But now it's not that way. You've got to spend millions of dollars on a usually unsuccessful Easter egg hunt looking for a prospect. Then if you find a prospect, you got to spend tens of millions to prove it up. And then it looks like you really got something. You got to spend scores of millions more to develop it. And then you build the mine. You're talking about typically hundreds of millions of dollars. And then your trouble really starts after 10 years of investing capital with no return. Finally, you're in production. And now you got to deal with royalties and taxes from the government, where you'll be treated like a milk cow. You'll have NGOs shaking you down and making your life miserable. You'll have native groups harassing you, and 100 other things, technical things that can go wrong. So it's a terrible business, gold mining. One of the worst businesses there is. That's the bad news. The good news is that right now, as we speak, gold mines are about as cheap as they've ever been. in real terms relative to other things. I think they're a good speculation right now, but they're a speculation. They're not an investment. An investment is something where you put a dollar someplace and it grows. It grows by producing things. And speculation is where you're hoping on things. It's different. Gold mining is like that. I think it'll work out very well. It's possible. I think it's likely based on what gold mines have done about five times over the last 50 years. Now, the whole group could easily go 10 to 1. Lots of individual companies could go 100 to 1. I've actually owned two companies that went, believe it or not, this is not a lie, it's just a fact, 1,000 to 1. Not over a course of a lifetime. That'd be enough. Over the course of a 3 or 4 year cycle. So, yeah, I think they're a good place to allocate a little bit of money.
Mm. Because I know one of the threats, I think, with business now and a number of these businesses, all of this ESG hoo-ha that seems to be infecting a number of businesses, particularly sit in stock exchanges and things like mining, for example, in this country, massive hot potato. It's not ESG compatible at all. Do you think when the affluence...
ESG, as we both know, is it's a sham. It's all bullshit. Mm. I mean, it's silly. And here in the U.S., maybe less in New Zealand, you've got DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is even more deadly and more stupid. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, not at all. Because that sort of leads to the nub of the question, really. I mean, that's part of these bread and circuses that I mentioned at the beginning. I look at all those ideologies that only being able to flourish in an environment of affluence. If things do actually head into this sort of greater depressionary period and that affluence starts getting trimmed, for example, if you look in Africa, you're not going to see people getting exercised about someone using the wrong pronouns, for example. No. So in the Western canon, that actually reduction in this overall affluence will be the inoculation against all of these social controls, which in turn are creating very bad financial and governmental decisions.
Well, you're right. All that's got to be turned around. And it starts with, a moral recognition about what's right and what's wrong, a moral recognition of what's productive and unproductive. Change your own life, change your family, convince your friends. But I'm afraid most people are trying to change things politically. Well, that's nice, of course. But you have to recognize that you don't get the best kind of people to go into politics. In fact, you get the worst kind of people. I don't care how glib they are, how much they smile, how smooth they are talking. The fact is, people that go into politics, with very, very few exceptions, are power seekers. They're busybodies. They want to tell you what to do and make it look like it's something else. If it wasn't for politics, I don't know what most of them would be doing, but they'd be lucky to be sweeping the streets, which would be better, because at least they'd be doing something that's productive and is helping as opposed to hurting people. I can't tell you how much I despise politics. But on the other hand, once in a while, there's an oddball like Javier Milei in Argentina that comes up, gets where he is somehow, and hopefully he can break the logjam. But don't plan your life around it. That's probably a once-in-a-century one-off. I hope not. And will it happen in New Zealand? I don't know. Do you have any anarcho-capitalist people that are raising hell in New Zealand right now to want to do what Javier Milei did in Argentina?
On the fringe parties, they sort of in spirit perhaps, but not in actuality. Mind you, we do have, so the coalition is the National Party, which is essentially the same as the Labour Party, but with they wear a different colour tie. They've gone into coalition with Winston Peters. You may remember him from when you were living here because he's been around that long. Yeah. So Winston is currently the Deputy Prime Minister, and he, of course, he was the one that went into coalition with the Labour Party, and he is being a centrist. He sort of blows either way, but the one advantage with them is that they are very focused on what's happening here at home. So, for example, things like the mining, they're looking at focus on that, and they realise that there's a tremendous amount of wealth here in New Zealand sitting under our feet, for example. So they are looking at sort of prospects there. And then the third party, which is the ACT Party, the centre-right party, they're quite keen on deregulation. So their leader there, he's pushing quite hard to sort of help try and trim some of the fat out of the public sector, because the public sector in this country got bloated by, I think it was around 40% it grew under the previous administration. So you've got a lot of people, a lot of shiny butts accommodating stools and chairs and desks in Wellington and around the country that really were surplus to requirements. And that's now starting to be trimmed, and they're not happy about it at all. So they're not quite going Javier type cuts, but they're certainly making enough cuts that they're squealing.
Well, that's very nice that they do that. But I fear that they're doing it just for pragmatic reasons. They're not principled. And therefore, when the next slimy, slick politician gets in office, they'll hire back all these worthless people. And they'll do other things that are going to muck things up for the average guy. So the key is you get a firebrand who's principled, like Javier Milei in Argentina. And it doesn't sound like somebody in New Zealand has identified himself yet that way.
No, definitely not. Definitely not.
It's one of pity because I really enjoyed my time in New Zealand. Liked everything about the country, quite frankly. Mm. The only reason why probably I'm not in New Zealand right now and I'm not a Kiwi citizen is because the tax system. I mean, I didn't engage in proper tax planning at great expense with lawyers and all this before I became a landed immigrant, and it just would have been too damned expensive to be in New Zealand. Otherwise, I'd love to be there with you. I think it's a great place.
It's interesting how different issues manifest themselves when they import. So the whole sort of DEI and sort of wokeism as a general rule down here has manifested itself a lot in the form of racial separatism, essentially. So when I grew up, in the 70s, I grew up in an area that was very much biracial, so just as many Māori as there were Pākehā or European of European descent. And everyone just sort of rubbed along just fine. Whereas now you have a lot of ethno-nationalist Māori who do not represent Māori as a whole. But of course, they've realised the political and activist and social capital of banging that ideological drum and how they can control a lot of money that comes out of government in order to feather their own nests. And a lot of that has gone on in the last 10 years, especially the last 7 or 8, particularly with the previous government. That
sounds just like what it is here in the US, where these professional race baiters like Obama, who he's so slick, he's so smooth, he's so mellow sounding, and these people talk about harmony between the races and so forth. But the fact is that until these people come along, I mean, people of different racial backgrounds just treat each other as people. But then these horrible, horrible politicians start identifying everybody as members of a race and drawing attention to it and giving special treatment to some races as opposed to others, creating an environment of envy and race hatred. So the more a politician talks about race equity, the better the chances are that he's a criminal personality. It's going to make things a lot worse.
Mm. I know you're heading back to South America by the time the fun and games in November there get underway, and I know you abhor politics, but you must be looking at what's going on in the last few months and just be shaking your head thinking, man, I want to go back to my anarcho-capitalist as soon as I can.
You're asking who's going to win in November in the U.S.? Actually, it turns out that I don't have such a bad track record of handicapping these things. Maybe I'm just lucky. But in 2016, when Trump won, the odds were hugely against him. The Las Vegas was offering 4-1 against. And I bet on Trump. Money bet, I've got to say, with a close personal friend. And I won. In 2020, I bet on Biden for 6 reasons. I won't go into those now, but regrettably, I won again. Not that Trump was any great prize back in 2016, but now it's Trump against Kamala. And Kamala is unintelligent. I mean, she's really a dumb bunny. She's ignorant. She knows nothing. She's never been out, done anything ever outside of government. That's the way she's wired. She's got bad moral character, and she's philosophically malign. I mean, she's actually a communist. So the problem is that the media and entertainment and academia are all thumping the tub for her. A lot of people hate Donald Trump, who's basically just saying the same thing he said before. And he annoys a lot of people. I mean, I don't mind him. I think he's very entertaining, personally. I don't mind Donald at all. But the problem with Donald is that he doesn't have a philosophical core. I mean, he's in many ways a practical, commonsensical business guy, okay? But, you know, a lot of people don't realize that during his 4 years, he spent and borrowed more government money than even the criminal Obama regime has in the last 4 years. So he's not going to be an economic savior. Yes, he deregulated. He understands that. A lot of things. That's very good. I appreciate that. And maybe he showed very, 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 very bad judgment in selecting people around him. Maybe he's learned a lesson. But maybe not. Leopards don't change their spots easily. My bottom line, way I'm guessing right now, the handicappers of Vegas, I guess, is leaning towards Kamala. God, people are so criminally stupid. About 53-47, roughly. Mm. And Bobby Kennedy has basically been excluded. I mean, he's a plus and minus kind of guy. I mean, he's got good things and bad things we can go over with. But he's not in the ring. They're not even going to let him on the ticket almost any place. Anything can happen in the next 90 days. But, I'm betting on Kamala and hoping I lose the bet.
Oh, I know. She's, from a media perspective, it has been incredible. Like that they're trying to emulate, and they've even said it, a Jacinda Ardern type effect, media and the whole machinery around her. And I was like, oh, be careful what you wish for. Yeah. But there you go. Oh, well, it is always fascinating to chat to you, and I do appreciate your time today, Doug. Doug Casey, international man. Where can people find you if they want to look up some of your writings, things that you do, advice? You've got a wonderful community, I know, that you have with, is it Matt Smith?
Matt Smith.
Yeah, your offsider.
Yes. I'd urge your listeners to perhaps do at least one, but perhaps 3 out of 3 things I'll recommend. Number one, on the internet, go to internationalman.com and sign up for a free blog. I write weekly. We have lots of other really great writers. I think you'll like it. So sign up at internationalman.com. Lots of really good information. Point number two, I have a YouTube channel with my friend Matt Smith. So go to YouTube. And it's called Doug Casey's Take. sign up for that. We do one or two a week. And the third thing is, if you like to read, there's three novels that are out that I've done with John Hunt, and Reforming, Unjustly Besmirched Occupations. And they're quite exciting and quite good, following our hero through his life. First, as speculator about a bush war in Africa. Second, as drug lord about the drug business. Third, as assassin, where our hero becomes an assassin. So read those three. I think you're in.
You mentioned those last time. Yeah. No. Have you got a fourth in the wind?
Fourth, yeah, that's going to be called Terrorist. We've got a lot of thoughts on terrorism as a method of warfare. And so Charles gets involved, not really, but he's accused of being involved in terrorism. And I think that'll be quite interesting, because terrorism is a very up-and-coming method of warfare. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to be an exciting book. Maybe it'll be out in the next year. Who knows?
There you go. Oh, Doug, it's been an utter joy to speak with you today. This has been Doug Casey, International Man, here with Counterculture with Marie on Reality Check Radio. Marty, still to come. Don't disappear. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks. Been a pleasure.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.